Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of May 15th, 2018. This week, we briefly recap the 2018 legislative session, which officially concluded last week, but lawmakers still have more work to do in the off-season. Also, we're a month away from the primaries, so we'll check in on what's been percolating on the campaign trail. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who wrote the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections while you complain about it getting hot. Guess what? You live in South Carolina. It's going to be hot. Or while you craft your fascinator in anticipation for the 4 a.m. royal wedding watch party that you're going to attend. Oh, bully good show, bully good. And now quorum call. Good day, good day. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present. But here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the state newspaper reports that two advocacy groups are calling for teachers and state workers to rally this Saturday on the Statehouse grounds in Columbia. Their reporting has found that nearly 1 in 10 South Carolina public school teachers quit their job last year. Meanwhile, state workers long have argued their pay is too low, leading them to find jobs elsewhere, particularly in higher-paying private sector jobs, fueling a staffing shortage at state agencies. Number two, the state newspaper reports that two of the 22 inmates injured at Lee Correctional Institution in last month's prison riot that left seven others dead are suing the state for unspecified damages. Both lawsuits accuse the State Department of Corrections of gross negligence, including failing to provide proper security and speedy medical treatment. DOC has acknowledged it needs at least 600 more correctional officers to properly staff some of its 21 prisons, as well as more money to increase security. Number three, the Aiken Standard reports that the U.S. Department of Energy has moved to end the mixed oxide fuel fabrication facility at the Savannah River site. The Trump administration decision follows a similar defunding plan recommended by the Obama administration. Now, MOX, unfinished after more than a decade of work, is designed to turn weapons-grade plutonium into commercial reactor fuel. The facility is a product of a U.S.-Russia agreement, which required both countries to dispose of 34 metric tons of plutonium. The facility will transition into producing plutonium pits, which are nuclear weapon cores, often called triggers. And number four, a programming note, ETV has a week's worth of royal wedding coverage for you. Each night this week on ETV stations across the state, you can tune in around 10 p.m. and find out the latest as we lead up to Saturday's live broadcast coverage starting at 4 a.m. to 9 a.m., covering the royal wedding between Prince Harry, his royal highness Prince Harry, and American Meghan Markle, the actress. So tune in this week each night on ETV stations at 10 p.m. for coverage, again, leading up to the royal wedding. Only 4 a.m. to 9 a.m.? Literally not enough. Oh, but wait! Rebroadcast happens right at 9 a.m. So you can catch that if you're not one of the people waking up at 4 a.m. Or you can be like me and watch it twice. And once again, the monarchy has forced us to bury the lead. Sorry, chap. Righto. Well, we have made it. The 2018 legislative session is done and in the books. We've accomplished it. We've done it. We've made it through. We survived. We are alive to tell the tale. And we're going to today. That's why we're going to look back at the 2018 legislative session with Post and Courier reporters Andy Brown and Jamie Lovegrove, while we're also going to look at the June 12th primaries coming up. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Despite the VC summer nuclear debacle taking much of the air out of the legislative session this year, lawmakers still managed to pass several bills to the governor's desk, including several big business-friendly bills. With minutes left on the last day of session on Thursday, senators sent a landmark reform bill to the governor that will create a ballot referendum question in November, asking voters if they want the governor to appoint the superintendent of education instead of it being elected. Work still remains, including the passage of the $8.2 billion state budget and VC summer-related bills, which is among the reasons lawmakers are already planning to come back on May 23rd and June 27th. That latter date is important because June 27th is the day after any primary runoffs, and lawmakers will take up budget vetoes handed down by the governor. And we'll also round out the discussion with some campaign trail updates. Whip crack. So, Andy, let's start off with you. What were some of the big accomplishments from this session that lawmakers can look back at and be proud of passing outside of the debate we saw surrounding VC summer?
Yeah, so I actually covered three bills back mid-session almost that were pro-industry in many respects and were championed by the South Carolina Chamber of Commerce. They included bills such as one that would stop individuals or homeowners from challenging the expansion of a large poultry farms throughout mm-hmm. the state. The current law had allowed people within a certain radius, I think it was like 2 miles, mm-hmm. to essentially challenge or oppose the expansion of these large poultry farms that house thousands of birds.
Yeah.
From expanding, the law that the State House created this year shrank that geographic range to, I believe, within
one mile.
A half mile or a mile. Mm-hmm. And really, it was meant to make it so that poultry farms that were trying to expand or these large chicken or turkey farms would not have to run into as many hurdles as they were getting environmental permits. Mm-hmm. They did kind of the same thing for other industries as well. They did it with manufacturers. They passed a nuisance bill. Currently in state law, there's a way that homeowners can sue industrial property owners that are next door to them if they're creating too much light or noise or dust. The lawmakers, pro-business lawmakers, who are always trying to make it easier for large corporations in the state to do business, essentially restricted that and said, put it into state law that if you already live next to one of these industrial facilities, even if they expand somewhat or do some changes, as long as that business has the same state permit it had, you cannot sue them for a nuisance. And so that passed as well. Again, before the end of session. Mm-hmm. Finally, they passed a bill that essentially stops environmental groups from holding up large development projects. Essentially, environmental groups had taken the tactic of kind of stalling environmental permits in administrative law court, or so the businesses say. They wanted to do away with that. And so they put like a strict timeline on how long those permits could be held up by an environmental group through a challenge in the administrative law court.
And that's the auto stay bill is what it was known as.
Correct.
It's automatically staying those appeals in that process. So and then also, of course, the liquor bill, which we all
love,
about, you know, Marlon Kimson, brown liquor.
Brown liquor.
Which essentially let, licensees in the state go from 3 liquor stores to 6. That's over a period of several years. And it's only, again, in several counties that you can do that. And if it's over a population of 250,000 people, you can have more additional liquor stores there, but no more than 2 in those big counties. So a lot of movement there. And so that is something that we get to, you know, lawmakers could walk away from the session with and say that they did accomplish something, because that was really the priority of Senator Shane Massey over in the Senate, Senate Majority Leader, who put all those bills, I believe all of them were on priority order, at least the chicken bill was, because we saw that filibuster from Marlon Kimson where we learned about his affinity for brown
liquor.
You know, the chamber really had a successful session if you look at it.
Yeah.
Even in the last couple days, they got another bill that I guess not as many people recognized they were backing, which was an expungement bill. There's a work.
They love coming up with great names for these bills. I think you got to admire that at least.
You know, they're way better than what's going on in Congress where you can't even understand what the bill means.
Yep.
But the expungement bill essentially allows people with some criminal histories, some minor criminal histories in South Carolina, to get offenses wiped off mm-hmm. their record in order for them to more quickly or to be able to get a job, essentially, and find work in South Carolina. And the chamber wanted that because with the tighter employment numbers, you know, they need more people and more bodies to staff up businesses that are moving to South Carolina. And so they actually got a version of that bill out this session, and it kind of ran under the radar in the last couple days there, but mm-hmm. It did actually pass.
Yeah, we're too busy looking at that bill that would make it a misdemeanor to litter cigarette butts. So all you smokers out there, you filthy smokers, stop licking your cigarette butts. I'm just kidding. We're underwritten by Philip Morris.
What about?
Just kidding.
But come on, Bubba on the boat.
Bubba on the boat. You can't spit your dip in the water. You can't do it on public or private property. But
it's like a $100 fine, right?
The South Carolina League does not endorse littering by any means. It can be up to $100, yeah, for sure.
Well.
But please stop littering, you. But this is not your ashtray out here. I've seen the billboards. Jamie, likewise, We were just on This Week in South Carolina, which is one of our shows on ETV that broadcasts every Friday evening at 7:30 and rebroadcasts on Sundays at 11:30 with Charles Bierbauer. He recaps the week with the newsmakers, and we talked about what happened this session and in some cases what didn't happen this session. So what didn't we see happen? What were some of the notable things that maybe we saw, we paid attention to, but just didn't make it across the finish line last Thursday when session ended right at 5 p.m., killing everything that hadn't been sent to the governor?
Well, of course, the big headline one that we still have not seen a resolution yet to is some of these nuclear reform bills after the collapse of the VC Summer project last year. And I'll let Andy go into more detail on that one because he's been following it very closely. But, you know, there were several other bills that got a lot of headlines that didn't end up getting through. The plastic bag bill, particularly for, you know, our prime audience down in Charleston and on the coast, that was a huge source of controversy. There are several municipalities around the state, particularly along the coast, that have banned the sale of plastic bags over the last few months and years. And the legislature was considering prohibiting them from doing that and from centralizing all bag regulations at the legislature. The House passed that measure. And I will also say that the House leaders who supported it said that, you know, this is just about point of sale. So you can't ban plastic. The bill would stop you from banning plastic bags at point of sale. You could still ban it on the beach. Mm-hmm. You could still ban them from being littered in parks, but you couldn't ban stores from selling plastic bags. It just got stalled up in the Senate. They did have support from quite a few Republicans there, but it also had opposition from quite a few Republicans. I mean, I talked to Senator Chip Campson, who is from down in Charleston. Senator Tom Davis, I believe, felt the same way. You know, the folks that are along the coast feel very strongly that cities should have the right to regulate their own policies there. Mm-hmm. I did talk to Senate Majority Leader Shane Massey about this on the last day of session, and he certainly sounded like this may well come back up again next year. One of our reporters out in Myrtle Beach, Chloe Johnson, has talked to some of the plastic bag lobbying groups, and they've certainly said they plan to continue pushing for it next year. Mm-hmm. And what Massey said, too, is he expects that by the time we come back to this next year, you know, there may well be quite a few more cities along the coast that have passed plastic bag bans. And he thinks that that may galvanize support for it, that the more cities that do it, perhaps more lawmakers that were on the fence about it may want to pass a ban. So I expect that'll come back up again next year.
I found the whole debate over that really fascinating, just from a Republican standpoint.
Right.
Lawmakers who, a party that constantly references local government, and these arguments came up in the State House, but now pushing to take away control from local government.
Yep, home rule.
And it's a really fascinating dichotomy of the Republican Party in the State House. Beyond that, though, like, I find it fascinating because I really wonder whether these large bag manufacturers really care about one or two small towns. I think it's the trend, right? It's if this happens on the coast, all of a sudden this spreads to North Carolina, this spreads to Virginia, this spreads to Florida.
Yeah.
All of a sudden you lose half your
revenue. That's always what they're worried about. And we do know, you know, what we should mention that one of the major bag manufacturers is in the district of House Speaker Jay Lucas. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the reason, you know, why it did have some strong support from House leadership. I will also say, you know, you asked other things that have not come up this session. Something we talked about a lot in December and January and then pretty much fell off the map was pension reform. We passed phase one last year. I mentioned this on This Week last Friday. Mm-hmm. As I said then, you have to give credit to Senator Tom Davis from Beaufort, who said last year, if we do phase one, we're going to reduce the urgency, the crisis to deal with broader comprehensive reforms to the program. And as we all know and have experienced many times before, this is a legislature that tends to govern by crisis. Yeah. And if you take away that element of it, other things are just going to supersede it. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, we really, frankly, there wasn't even much discussion about this after the first couple months.
And that's trying to close that gaping $20, $24 billion shortfall in the state pension system, which sounds substantial. It's not entirely dire, but lawmakers did take a very big step last year in starting to throw some more money at this problem. And there was talk of having to do that again this year. But of course, we had another crisis, the VC Summer nuclear debacle, which superseded that. And Andy, what's the status of those bills? Jamie was just mentioning that we didn't see those passed yet, but there's a way that they can still pass them or work on them, rather, even though we're out of session right now. So what's the status there? What's what's on the table with these bills?
We're in overtime, Gavin. Okay, it's like Penguins versus Caps.
Oh yeah, can we just say?
Do we want to know how that story ended?
Yes, we do, Jamie.
The Caps won.
It was a weird year, man.
Yeah.
Anyway,
CAPS, Caps.
Woo.
In any case, no, the lawmakers, after you know all of fall getting these bills ready, and the House passing them early in the session. Again, it came down to the last day, literally, with almost all of these bills. Currently, they are now in conference committee. There are three different conference committees that are going to be
established. Are they going to merge that into one, do you know? Or is it
no, they're not.
Separate?
They're the House kind of sees it as getting several cracks at beating up on the Senate on this.
And the conference committee is made up of three House and three Senate lawmakers. That's when they try and hash out compromise between two versions of these bills, and that's where we are on several of these right now.
So the first one that passed and has already had two conference committee meetings was the 18% cut to scanner SCE&G's rates. Lawmakers are still split on that. The Senate wants a 13% reduction in rates. The House wants a full 18%, which makes up that nuclear surcharge that they call it. Mm-hmm. Then there is a bill on creating a consumer advocate and giving the Office of Regulatory Staff, the state's utility watchdog, more capability in requesting and gathering documents not only from utilities but also from their contractors, which is going to be extremely important as they try to decipher what happened to VC Summer. The ORS, from what I've been told, is going to be requesting documents as well from Westinghouse Electric, which was the Pittsburgh-based contractor that kind of led this nuclear effort up in Fairfield County.
So this will have like real-life implications once it does, if it gets passed into law. I mean, they'll be able to go immediately and start using these extended powers to...
I think if you would talk to most people who have been pushing for this in the lobby and in the state house, I would say that the subpoena powers that they want to give ORS are extremely important, but so is the creation of the consumer advocate. Mm-hmm. Many other states in the country have had a devoted office that represents the best interest of electric or gas or water customers in utility cases, and that has not been the case here in South Carolina since 2004. Now the Senate and House both want to create a consumer advocate's office. I believe they disagree on where they're going to place that. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be a huge part of any of this going forward in utility cases. All of a sudden, you're going to have this representative who is not arguing on behalf of the utilities. They're not arguing on behalf of the economy in the state. They are arguing on behalf of individual ratepayers' pocketbooks.
And can you explain what the situation is right now? Because right now, it is, like you said, it does combine kind of all those almost competing interests into one position. So what was the history here in this position?
If you look back, back in 2003, there was a huge kerfuffle, I guess you could call it, over commissioners, utility commissioners, which are on the Public Service Commission in South Carolina, were talking to lobbyists behind the scenes and talking to utility executives. Mm-hmm. And so they moved the staff of the utility office into this, what they created was the Office of Regulatory Staff. The Office of Regulatory Staff literally wore three different hats. They had to represent consumers, they had to represent the best interests of the state of South Carolina and its energy policy, and then they had to represent the financial integrity of the utilities. If you talk to most people in the industry, they don't quite understand that now because the utilities hire their own attorneys, high-paid attorneys, to represent them in these cases. Mm-hmm. And so the question is why is the state supplementing that? Both the House and Senate have seemingly agreed that the Office of Regulatory Staff should have no role in representing the financial integrity of the utilities moving forward and should be focused on the state and its people, mm-hmm. its ratepayers.
So we're going to start seeing some of those meetings in the off session?
Yes, they're going to be meeting. They're in conference committee. There mm-hmm. seems like a decent chance that something will come out of that, but that's yet to be seen. So,
and then even if we do reduce those rates like that one bill, I mean, is it likely? I mean, that's a temporary rate cut, and then they still have to actually determine if that's going to be a final rate cut at that point?
For anybody who's interested in what's going on with VC Summer, they should mark their calendars for November. Mm-hmm. And mid-December, because the PSC is going to be holding hearings in November on VC Summer, where all of the evidence is going to be laid on the table. They're going to be taking testimony from SCANA's executives. You know, it's a court hearing, essentially, okay. on utilities. And come December, the 7-member Public Service Commission is going to issue a ruling saying, here's how much customers have to pay moving forward, or here's how much they don't have to pay.
Mm-hmm. And Jamie, switching gears, what's going on in the governor's race? I know you're dying to like jump in over here. Today we're taping. Today it's Monday. This evening there's a Tea Party debate up in Greenville. Yes. Governor McMaster's not going to that. All the other candidates are going from the Republican side. We were talking about this. Is he snubbing them? Is he too busy, or is he just what's the advantage? Like, what's the strategy here in order to not attend something like that?
Well, you know, whenever the governor has missed campaign events, the other candidates have been at. Their campaign has said, you know, he's busy being governor, but I'm pretty sure I saw their campaign schedule this morning and he's just going to be campaigning down in Charleston this evening. So, look, when you're the front runner, which, you know, I think he still is, you know, the question really in this race is how close he can get to clearing that 50% threshold and avoiding a runoff. It seems increasingly unlikely he'll be able to do that. But when you're the front runner, you know, and we've seen this on the Democratic primary as well with James Smith, the more debates you participate in, the more opportunities you're giving to your challengers to take hits at you, to damage you, to, you know, inflict any kind of critical wounds that you don't necessarily have to take. There's always the balance, basically, of is it worse to take the negative press and the negative attention of missing those debates and making it seem like you're avoiding discussing your policies, or is it worse to give your challengers that opportunity? Mm-hmm. You know, we've also seen in general that the McMaster campaign has not been as open to the Tea Party all over the state as some of the other campaigns. You know, I think he's missed a couple Tea Party events, you know, out in Horry County and some other Tea Party issues, whereas he's gone to more of the, you know, Republican Party county meetings. And, you know, they are a very vocal group. You know, these are some of the most committed partisans in the state. They are folks who will vote in the primary. The question is really just how big are their numbers at this point? There's always questions about whether the Tea Party is just a very loud and small group in South Carolina, or whether they do really have the numbers to change the dynamic of a primary. And that may be something we'll see on June 12th.
And we did see that he's also not attending the televised College of Charleston debate on Wednesday evening.
Yeah.
But he is attending both SCE TV debates, which we'll have later.
And Post and Courier.
Yeah.
I mean, I will say, and the Post and Courier and ETV.
You're welcome, Mitch.
ETV and Post and Courier did a lot of advanced work on this, spent months preparing for this. You know, now we've started to see over the last month or two that, you know, suddenly everyone else is like, wait, I want a debate.
Yeah, and, this is months,
you know,
in the making.
And I can understand why some of the campaigns would be frustrated that, you know, now feels like they're getting, you know, debate invitations every day. Now, and this is just the way it is all over the country is, you know, of course, challengers who are trying to gain, they need the attention, they need the focus on them. Frankly, even if they don't land a direct hit on the front runner, just by people watching the debate, they may learn their name for the first time.
Yeah.
So, of course, they want to have as many debates as possible. If it was up to them, they would have a debate every single night between now and June 12th.
Free airtime, free advertising.
Right,
free.
But we will have an opportunity for Governor McMaster to be on the same stage as all of them. I'm not worried about that.
And speaking of name recognition, I want to kind of tie this all up, but we did see last week at the Democrats, two of the candidates there announced their running mates now. So all three Democrats running in the gubernatorial primary have running mates.
Right.
Kind of fill us in here and just tell us who got what, where we are right now with those Democratic candidates, and how strategic of a play it is to have a running mate at this stage.
So we already knew Marguerite Willis a couple months ago had announced State Senator John Scott from Columbia, an African-American senator from Columbia, as her running mate. On Thursday of last week, we saw Phil Noble, a Charleston businessman, announce that Dr. Gloria Bramall Tinubu would be his running mate. She is a Georgetown economist. She's been a college professor. She was actually a legislator in Georgia for a couple of years and then moved back here, and she was on the Atlanta City Council. And then on Friday, James Smith, the state representative from Columbia, announced that another state lawmaker, Mandy Powers Norrell from Lancaster, would be his running mate. And Lancaster is a very interesting part of the state in that, you know, Mandy Powers Norrell, since she was elected in 2012, has not really faced any Republican opposition, but it's actually a very red district. That's a district that voted for Trump. It's a district that leans, according to the sort of average historical election data I've seen from the last several elections, about 19 points in favor of Republicans, and yet she's completely closed out the competition. Mm-hmm. So this is really a general election move from Smith to try to win over moderate Republican support. You know, Mandy Powers Norell has demonstrated she has crossover appeal to Republicans. We do see, of course, you know, it's impossible to miss that that is an all-white ticket. And both Phil Noble and Marguerite Willis have an African-American on their ticket at this point. The question is going to be, is that going to make a difference to black voters who make up a massive portion of the Democratic primary in South Carolina? Or are black voters going to listen to some of their most influential leaders, Jim Clyburn, Representative John King, who's the leader of the Legislative Black Caucus? We saw Terry Alexander from Florence, from Marguerite Willis's backyard at James Smith's event on Friday. They're all saying there is nothing that James Smith could do to more clearly show his support for the African-American community than what he's done in the last 22 years in the State House. You know, I think that John King even literally used the word tokenize. He said, you know, James Smith does not need to tokenize on his ticket to demonstrate his support for the African-American community. So that's going to be a very interesting aspect of the Democratic primary to watch over the next next month.
Yeah, and it's my understanding that he was looking at three different women for that his shortlist for his
That is the other thing to notice to mention is that they are all there's geographic diversity in all of the running mate choices, and there's gender diversity. All three tickets now. And same with Governor McMaster, who of course picked Pamela Evett, traveler dressed businesswoman last year. So every candidate that has chosen a running mate at this point has chosen someone of the opposite gender.
Really kind of get that strategy in place there.
Yep.
Well, a lot to watch. Again, we are less than a month away from the June 12th primary. And even though we are now at a session, we still have some things working through, including the $8.2 billion budget, which is also in conference committee, and some VC summer nuclear bills that we know Andy Brown, and the rest of the State House press corps will be watching closely. Because even though we're at a session, we're not technically at a session. So I think my signing die celebration was a little
As I said on the last day of session, I tweeted, I said, it feels like the last day of the semester, except everyone already knows they're coming back for summer school in 2 weeks anyway. So it's a little bit of a premature
triggering me.
There.
You're triggering me. I never went to summer school, but geez, that was always a close call.
Tension, maybe, as Justin Bamberg said.
Jamie Lovegrove and Andy Brown from the Post and Courier, you guys, thank you again for joining me.
Thanks, Kevin.
Move them on, head them up. It's time for the campaign trail, and we are inside of a month to go before the primaries. Here's a roundup of some campaign trail news for you. Let me get that whip crack that we want you to know about as we head in to the June 12th primaries. In a new TV spot, South Carolina GOP gubernatorial candidate Catherine Templeton fires a .38 caliber revolver she said her grandfather gave her to shoot snakes around her family's Oconee County fishing trailer while talking about fixing corruption and wasteful spending in state government. The Post and Courier reports that the ad includes a shot of a rattlesnake. Templeton aims the gun toward the ground and fires two shots and says, quote, "We can't shoot the snakes slithering around Columbia, but we will end their poisonous big government ways." Another little campaign trail tidbit. Congressman Mark Sanford is airing two 30-second TV spots highlighting his pro-wall stance in an attempt to better align himself with President Donald Trump, someone he's feuded with, but also someone his challenger, State Representative Katie Arrington, has heavily associated herself with. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that the Russ McKinney is in studio with me today, and we're doing a live question and answer type Did You Know? This week, where I don't even know the question he's going to ask me, but he's putting me on the spot right now for a Did You Know? Trivia question. So, Russ, go ahead and take it away.
Talk about magistrates. Everybody's heard of a magistrate. There are a number of them in every county in the state. There are about 300 magistrates across the state. Magistrates generally have trial jurisdiction over all offenses that are subject to penalty as a fine, but generally not exceeding, say, $500. And I think they also can imprison someone for something, a penalty of no more than 30 days. So they generally, they're at the lowest level of the court system in South Carolina. So my trivia question for you is, who is the chief magistrate of South Carolina?
Jeez Louise.
Who is the chief magistrate of South Carolina? This should be very easy, but I'll give you some choices.
Oh, okay.
A.
I think I know.
A, it is the senior circuit court judge in the 5th Judicial Circuit, which is Columbia, Richland County, the state capital. B, the governor. C, the chief justice of the state Supreme Court. Or D, none of the above.
I'm going to go with C. I'm going to go with chief justice, Supreme Court.
If you go to the state constitution and you look at the section for the governor, the very first words are the governor is the chief magistrate of the state of South Carolina. I think what that probably meant back in the day, although it's certainly still there today, is the chief executor of the laws. He's the chief law enforcement officer of South Carolina. A lot of times you'll hear about the attorney general is the chief, you know, law enforcement officer, but it's pretty clear the governor is the chief law enforcement officer in South Carolina. Therefore, he is the chief, or she is, the chief magistrate.
Well, I declare, Russ McKinney, I declare a gotcha question by Russ McKinney using the state constitution. Thank you very much, Russ, for that insightful tidbit of South Carolina trivia right there.
You're welcome.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out SCETV.org for news headlines, listen to South Carolina Public Radio daily for news, and check out my Twitter @GavinJackson. All of that, this podcast and more is available at SCETV's super easy to use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find podcasts. You can also find us on the NPR One app. Follow us on Instagram at @SCLEDEPOD, which is at @SCLEDPOD, where you can see photos from the studio, some of our funny memes, photos from around the statehouse, and on assignment. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at @SCLEDPOD. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in the South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on May 14th, 2018. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message number 3. It's 1:30, and the Queen Mum is hungry.
Blood pudding.